You may know that I teach a weekly Parsha class here at Ikar in Los Angeles every Thursday at noon, Pacific time. You're welcome. We've got folks joining us virtually from places as far away as Japan on Zoom. And we've been archiving video edits of the classes on YouTube, but we thought we might try cutting down the 1 hour class to about 40 minutes for you, for the listeners of the Best Book Ever podcasts that might not be able to fit a midday class on a Thursday into your schedule. So I hope you enjoy listening to these as much as I enjoy teaching them. If you're interested to attend the class from wherever you are in the world in person, then stick around at the end of the podcast. I'll tell you how to register. Just like the podcast, it's absolutely free, and we'd love to have you. Here we are at the end of the book of Exodus. We are finishing the book of Exodus. And the end of the book of Exodus is sort of a funny moment. There's something very grand about this moment because the book ends with the final erection of the tabernacle. Like it's finally stood up and the cloud of glory hovers over it, and God is now, they did it. They built a space for God. And that's a it's a sort of glorious moment. Nice to have that ending at the end of Exodus, because we've been sort of pushing through parsha after parsha, detailing the construction of this thing, this tabernacle, this Mishkan. There's a little the book of Exodus is a strange book in that way, because it is maybe the best storytelling in the Torah, and then suddenly it gets very detail heavy. First laws, and then the construction of the tabernacle, and that stuff is just very dense, very methodical, not so easy to read. So then, but then it's finished, and we do have a sense that, okay, well, that was all worth it, because here's the presence of God. What I want to do with you all today is to look at some of the language in that final scene of construction and then erection, and to take note of some of the parallels that we see between the tabernacle and the construction of the tabernacle, and then and creation itself. Okay, so I want to do some of, I wrote about this week. You may have seen me write about this a little bit. I want to take us into some of the material that I wrote about this week, and then move a little further in that story, the story of the Midrash Tanhuma especially imagines of what it was like to finally get that tabernacle up. And I was surprised, I must say, I was surprised by some of the material I found this week. And I think it all raises, all of this is, and we'll do some literary work, we'll do some sort of spotting parallel language, but all of this, of course, is theological work. It has raised some very big and difficult questions about what it means to build a home for God in this world. Okay, so let's say a blessing, and then we'll do some of that work. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. This work of studying Torah is like, this is our version of building a tabernacle. We don't build the tabernacle anymore. We read about it. So we think of this mitzvah of studying Torah as like filling the space of a lot of mitzvot, doing the work sort of in our minds that once was done in practice. So let's begin. Now, As I said, I wrote about this week, and part of what I want to do is just to give a quick review of some of the parallels that I noted, parallels that are noted before me by a host of great biblical scholars in the 20th century. And part of what I wanted to hear, so here's the piece I wrote this week, and part you can read that later, but that's where some of the material we're going to be looking at today comes from. But part of what I wanted to say right away in this piece was, yeah, sure, Martin Buber, who you may know from his philosophy, but was also a fine biblical scholar, Martin Buber gets some credit for making these links, but the truth is, the rabbis of the Midrash did it centuries earlier. Okay, that's like part of the point that I want to make is that this is these connections. It isn't the kind of literary method that we use is influenced by modern techniques of literary analysis, but the rabbis themselves of old were just brilliant readers, and so they it would be surprising if they had missed these connections, and indeed they have not. Okay, so let's take a look. Let's just start with the connections, just because if nothing else, if you just see the way that the end of the book of Exodus takes us right back to the beginning of the book of Genesis, that's beautiful enough that you should see. So let's take a look at that, and we'll just put a source sheet in the chat. So let's go to the sources, and I'm going to do it in this form here. By the way, I don't know how you look at it, but this is how I send it to you. It looks like this. I don't know if you click on it separately. And then when I press, I'm just like, when I press edit, it goes to this format, which I think is just better for our classes. So I don't know exactly what it looks like on your end and whether you can get to this, but that's what I do, and it does. You know, I'll be sharing it from my screen anyway. So, technical note there. Okay, so let's take a look here. This is a very famous section of the Torah, not just because it ought to be. It's the end of the 7 days of creation, but also because we say it every Friday night in our Kiddush. This has become liturgy. Okay, I've bolded the words here that we will soon see parallels to. They're all, you know, densely compacted into this little summary, but we'll soon see them spread out all over our parsha, same kind of language. So, Vayar Elohim et kol asher asa, v'hineh tov me'od, v'hi erev v'hi voker yom hashishi. God saw all that had been made, and behold, it was very good. Behold, that word behold, I'll bold that as well. Hineh, hineh, because when that word comes up, it's distinct. Oh, it points something out, and we're going to see that parallel as well. And behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Yom Hashishi. Vayichulu hashamayim va'aretz v'chol tzva'am. The heaven and the earth were finished. This is the language for finished, vayichulu. And then that language repeats, vayichal Elohim b'yom hashvi'i melachto asher asa. And on the seventh day, God finished, Vayechal, all the work that had been undertaken. I don't know why they're putting in the passive here. I would say that God had done, Asher Asa. Vayishpot, and God rested on the seventh day. There's that language of Shabbat, Vayishpot, from doing any of the work. Vayvarchalim et yom hashvi vaykadesh oto. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. Because on it, God ceased from all the work of creation that God had done. And I guess I ought to also bold this word here, malachto, which comes up a lot, the work, the labor, because in some ways that's the most straightforward connection to the tabernacle. Now I'm going to take us into Exodus, where you can already see that word. You see the work. But it's more than that. All of this language, it's as if someone studied this
conclusion to the creation story in Genesis and started using it in the conclusion to the creation of the tabernacle. Vayar, and Moses saw the all et kol hamalacha vehine. Okay, we've got three of our words there already. So a verse like this should catch our eye. Vayar, there he saw all of the work, malachto, vehine, and behold. So Moshe saw all the work, and behold, just as the Eternal had commanded, so they had done, and Moses blessed them. I'm going to return to this verse later because you can already hear some other parallels, but let's just do this in order. I'm going to try to go in order of the construction here of the verses in Genesis. So Moses saw all the work, thus was completed. Vatechel, kol avodat mishkan, and thus was completed all the labor of the mishkan. This is not a common verb, the completing, so we note it, and we would certainly also, now, I just want to make clear, I'm cutting and pasting here, I'm chopping apart various verses, because you have to do some rearranging to see all of this, but if we rearrange, then I think it does, the picture comes into focus. So I'm going back a little bit where the language of 6 days and the seventh day is also used. The presence of God abode on Mount Sinai and the cloud hid it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, God called from Moses in the midst of the cloud. And when Moses had finished the work, here it is again, Vayichal Moshe et Hamalacha, and Moses saw all the work. Here's the same verse again, and behold, just as the Eternal commanded them, so they had done, Vayivarech Otam Moshe, and Moses blessed them. And just for good measure, let's remember that this whole project started with, Va'asu li mikdash, make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. That's the first command, and I include that as well because the language of blessing and the language of sanctification are also right there in the creation story, and we return to them here in the construction of the Mishkan. Okay, so with all of these keywords, some of them, okay, you might say, well, blessing. I mean, is this the only place we've seen blessing in the Torah? But once you have blessing and completion and work and 6 days and seventh and the seventh day and holiness and even the little flourishes of and he saw vahine and behold, that's all very much creation language. Okay, all right. So that in itself, I think, is pretty cool just to see, and we'll pause and reflect on that. That's really the important thing. Why is the Torah doing this? But before we do that, I just want to make the same kind of almost polemical point that I made in the essay, which is just to say, oh, look at these fancy modern biblical critics finding these connections. But let's always presume that our rabbis were on the same page. And maybe centuries earlier. And I'm not going to read, I don't think I'll read all of this, but just to give you a sense of this kind of work being done by the rabbis of the Midrash. This is a Midrash Tanchuma, which was collected in the 10th century, but so it's a late Midrash, but it collects opinions from much earlier. And here it is. Here's the parallel. Rav Yaakov, the son of Isi, asks, why does it say, I love the habitation of your house? I didn't have a chance to retranslate this, so forgive, the language is a little archaic. I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. And in Hebrew, that's Ahavti Me'on Beitecha, I loved the your house, U'mekom Mishkan Kavodecha, and the place of dwelling, and the language of dwelling there, right here, is Mishkan. So, what is there a hint there? Yes. He says that because the tabernacle, the Mishkan, is equal to the creation of the world itself. Okay, there's the statement that we really want to be thinking about today. Sheshakul keneged briyat olam. The tabernacle is like the creation of the world. And how so? Now, the Midrash here will catch some of the connections that we saw here when we laid it out according to Buber's scheme. But, and I say Buber's scheme, but I got it through Nechama Leibovitz, I should say. Nechama Leibovitz writes a beautiful piece on this. I cited it in the essay. And she talks about all of the modern scholars who are doing this work in parallelism and repetition. That's the kind of work we do in this class a lot. But let's give credit where credit is due. The Midrash is also doing some of that work. But the Midrash's connections are even further reaching. So this is, yes, the same kind of work, but it's the Midrash is sort of known for its boldness interpretive style. So some of these things you're going to feel are a little bit more of a stretch, but it's still, you can see the attempt. It's still beautiful work. So let's take a look at some of the, how do they make the connection between the creation of the world and the tabernacle? Well, on the first day, it's written God created the heaven and the earth. But elsewhere, meaning in the Psalms, the creation is described as God who stretched out the heavens like a curtain, and in the tabernacle there's a curtain. Okay, now that seems like that might be is that really a great parallel? Over in Psalms, it's like the heavens are a curtain and there's a curtain in the tabernacle, but they keep going for looking, because what they really want to do, or what Rav Yaakov ben Asi really wants to do, is he wants to make a parallel not just for the whole creation, as we saw in the verses, but for every single day of creation. So the second day, the firmament divided between the waters, and in the tabernacle, the parochet, the curtain, divided between you. On the third day, it says, let the waters under the heavens be gathered. So in the tabernacle, there is a water basin. Okay? Now, again, there's something a little bit more attenuated and a little more playful about these connections, but it's still kind of impressive. Look, here's a good one. This one will be fairly intuitive. On the fourth day, God created light, as it says, let there be light. Lights in the heaven. God created light on the first day, but the lights, meaning the illuminating lights of the sky, and in the tabernacle, there's a menorah. So there you start to see, we don't have to go through every single day, but you start to see that the Midrash is looking for not just the general sense that God created the world, we created a home for God, but actually trying to think, well, God thought to illuminate the world, we have to remember to illuminate the tabernacle for God. And God thought to put curtains in the world. And we have to put up nice little curtains for God. Like there's a kind of a back and every single day moving through. And I said, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let's just see if there's anything else that's worth looking at here. Oh, just so you know, those connections which were a little bit more of a stretch, like, oh, the psalmist said that the world was spread open like a curtain. But by the end, they're doing the exact same work that modern scholars are doing. Look, thus was completed all the work of the tabernacle, just like the heaven and the earth were completed. God blessed them just like Moses blessed them. God finished just like Moses finished. So it's all like, it really is kind of connection for connection, all there in the Midrash. Okay. Now, okay, I hope that you find that as lovely and impressive as I do. That's the kind of reading that I'm always encouraging in this class. But now let's turn to the real question. What does all that mean? Why is all that happening? Why does the Torah, why does Moshe, why does God, put forth a whole parallel construction here now at the end of Exodus that takes us or reminds us of the construction of the world itself at the beginning of Genesis. So let's just start to do some of the theological work there. There's something happening. Why? What is the tit for tat, the response to, it's almost as if we are echoing God's work in creation. Let's start with Matt Silberstein, who today is in the form of a dog in a cage.
That's baby Dodie. He'll be showing up at shul in 4 weeks.
Hi, Dodie. All right, so give it to us, Matt.
Okay, there I am. I think that there are, it's this repetition is because there are two things the Torah is creating. The Torah is creating for us a Jewish religion, mostly a here are your rituals, here is you do it in Jerusalem, you have this religion, this is your God, and is creating a Jewish people. Hey, all of you guys, you may have these different ancestors and tribes and whatever, but you're all the same people. So I think all of this is a very deliberate repetition. I think it is absolutely, of all of the things we do, I think this is the most real in the Torah from the get-go, just like expulsions are repeated. Because you guys are going to get together and you're going someplace. Oh, that's Misha, those long legs.
Oh, my God.
It is creating for them and for us a Jewish religion, a Jewish people.
Okay, good. So, all right. So okay. That's good. That's an interesting parallel or connection. And it's almost like a, it's there's an echo there, but it's not quite a parallel. It's actually a distinction. The world is the place for everybody. God creates a world for all humanity. And then the construction of the tabernacle brings us into the particulars of the Jewish people, which by now, at the end of Exodus, we're in that story. And so there's a parallel construction, but it's a construction that is now centers us in the particulars of the Jewish religious experience. Okay, that's one way to think about it. Noah.
Yeah, the way I'm thinking about it centers around the word melacha. There are other words for work, like avodah, that's used often, and melacha here I'm seeing as the divine kingly work for a higher purpose that Moses and the people of Israel are doing with the Mishkan and all the work around bringing God into the world, where as the Avodah, it's like the person-to-person work that's just for our benefit and not for a higher benefit.
Okay, good. All right, so there's also a parallel in the Melacha, the idea that God does work and we do work. There's like a general parallel that we might speak of. God labors and then rests. So we too have labor in the world. We are creators. That much is seems like there. That's an obvious suggestion here. We, like God, do melacha. We do not just that we toil, but we actually construct something new. And Noah begins to suggest what that construction entails, which is the creation of a home for God on earth. Okay, let's continue to tease this out a little bit. Let's hear from Leah.
We've proved that we know how to construct things, and it was disastrous. We made the golden calf. Big trouble, serious big trouble. Thanks to Moses fighting for us, we get another chance. And this time, we got it right. So it's construction, but it's, we finally, we did the right thing, and it's glorious.
Great. Okay, great. That's great. Here we are thinking about the human capacity to create or to construct. And if we follow the time, the chronology of the Torah, we find that the tabernacle can either be read as a precedent to the golden calf or as a response to it. Tradition, at least according to Rashi, sees the tabernacle as a response to it. So here is, either way, here is an example of good labor, the construction of something holy that is worth blessing. We are certainly capable of creating disaster, and that's we've proven that. So there's a contrast for us. Okay, these are all excellent parallels. The the language invites us to suggest these parallels. I want to articulate one that sort of builds on, especially Noah's remarks that we build like God builds, but we build a home for God. And this is, I'm going to put it in Nechama Leibovitz's language, because I think she articulates it quite well. To me, this is one of the striking and biggest takeaways from the parallel. Here, I'm going to put it on screen. This is just from my essay this week, but I'm just quoting Nechama Leibovitz. And where is she? Here. This is what she says. The Lord created heaven and earth and all therein for man to dwell in, and created them in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. Similarly, Moshe was summoned on the seventh day to the cloud to see the pattern of the Mishkan that was his duty to erect in order to provide a place on earth for the divine presence. In other words, this, if nothing else, this is us. God created a world for us to dwell in. This is us creating a space in that world for God to dwell in. So that's like in some ways the mega parallel, or the sort of the echo, the reflection, the inversion, is that God creates space for us, we create space for God. That's an inspiring, a marvelous idea. But what does that mean? Why does God need space in the world? And what is it? What's the significance of us building a space for being like, we're the God in this situation, so to speak? We're allowing a place, like a habitation for our friend, the one who created all of this habitation for us. So why are we in that role? What's the significance of that? Let's turn to Richard.
Yeah, it's a related point, thinking about the whole notion of renewal of creation. And you can think about creation as something that happened kind of way back then in the beginning, but there are ways in which creation is renewed either every week, Shabbat, or every day, as we say in the prayers. And every time the tabernacle was re-erected was kind of the performance art of doing creation all over again. And so I like that idea of the built-in renewal of creation as inherent in the Mishkan in a way it was not in the Mikdash.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful. That's that notion that the world is, there's creation, but the world is constantly recreating itself, you know, and that God is HaMechadesh B'tuva B'chol Yom Tamid, is renewing constantly the work of creation. And someone said early on, well, we are creators too now. We become partners with God in creation. Oh, so look, we participate in the work, not just of creation, but of the renewal of creation. And don't we? I mean, what are we if not like the changers, the change agents in the world, the manipulators of that, which is the recreators of this existence? So Richard's right to say that the tabernacle speaks all kinds of suggests all kinds of things about our role in all of this. But before all that, it also just is a bold, powerful echo of that sort of creation keeps happening, creation keeps happening, creation keeps happening, and it's happening still. And we, you know, you could riff on this in lots of different ways, but like the opening of the book of Exodus, one of my favorite lines is of the Torah, Uvnei Yisrael paru vishatzu v'yirbu, and the children of Israel were fruitful and swarmed and multiplied. It's like, oh, a lot of what Exodus has been about is more creation, a new creation, a recreation, the creation of a nation, the creation of a new structure. That echo of creation is something to note and continue to look for, and it's especially here in the Mishkan. Okay, I wanted to, before we finished, show you one other midrash that I found by accident, because I had the wrong citation for the midrash that I already showed you. I thought it was in chapter 11, and I went searching for it, and it was in chapter 2 of Midrash Tanchuma in Parshat Pekudei. Not so important, but just to tell you that I stumbled upon this other midrash, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have to show this to the people, because I was very surprised by it. Because in chapter 11, we find a very different so far it's been so grand and glorious. Here we are, co-creators. Here we are echoing God's 7 days of creation with our own world. We're building a world for God, my goodness. But here's a voice in the Midrash that expresses a very different kind of sentiment, one of anxiety and trepidation, and perhaps the possibility of failure. Okay, so I want you to listen to this, and we've been having this conversation so far about what the implications are of us being creators, but take a look at, if that is so, at what this Midrash imagines. It's three paragraphs, and I'm going to read it through just so we get the story of it, and then we'll come back and process it a little bit. So pardon the length, but I think it's worth it. So let's see. Here we are. Everybody see the sheet that we're back on? Did that work? Okay, good. Okay, so this is 11, which I had cited incorrectly. So I went and I looked at it and I saw, oh my gosh, look at this. When at last they completed the work of the tabernacle, they sat waiting for the Shekhinah to descend and hover over. The Shekhinah is the divine presence, okay? So they're ready. We built it. God, come on in. However, they became distressed because the Shekhinah failed to hover over it. It didn't work. So what did they do then? They went to the wise-hearted men, Chochmei Lev, and that was the description the Torah used to describe those who were working, building, the builders of the Mishkan. So they went to the wise-hearted men and they said, why do you sit idly? Erect the tabernacle and the Shekhinah will come to rest them on it. So, you know, you've got it all here, like stand it up. And they tried to erect the tabernacle. They tried to, but they didn't know how, and they were unable to make it stand. Whenever they thought they had assembled it, it would fall apart. Okay. So then they went to, this is the master builder, the architect is God. I always want to say architect, but it's really the contractor. Bezalel is the grand contractor and his assistant Oholiab. And they say, come, erect the tabernacle you've constructed. Perhaps you will be worthy to erect it. Now, you know, these are the builders of the tabernacle. So, okay. They too tried to assemble it, but they were unable to do so. They began muttering and complaining. This is amazing. Itchilu misichin umarananin va'omrin. See what the son of Amram did to us. That's Moshe. Moshe's father is Amram, but they're not even giving him his name. He's just Ben Amram. See what the son of Amram did to us when he took our possessions for this tabernacle. Remember, the tabernacle was made of some of the gold that they had carried out of Egypt. And they made us subsume this burden while promising us that the Holy Blessed One would descend from the heavenly sphere and would dwell within the curtain of goat's hairs. Remember those curtains? All right. But what's the suggestion now? It's like, oh, look, God made the curtain out of the heavens, and God also asked for a curtain of goat hairs. But this Midrash is not saying, see, it's a parallel. This Midrash is saying, are you kidding me? A curtain of goat hairs, nothing like the curtain of the heavens. They can't do it. They can't do it. And here's the depressing conclusion to that story. Or actually, I guess there's a happy ending, because finally, they turn to Moshe. Now, why were they unable to erect it, to stand it up? Because of the fact that Moshe was distressed at not having participated in the construction of the tabernacle. He gave the instructions, but he didn't actually do the work. And he felt like sad at not having had a role. So remember, Moshe in the end is the one who finally finishes the work of the tabernacle. That is the, in some ways, the text here is, or the Midrash is playing with an issue in the text, which is that Moshe is not the one who builds the tabernacle. That's Bezalel. But in the end, he finishes it. So some of this is just playing with how do we get Moshe to be the one that finishes it? But take a look. It's not that simple, because they go to Moshe and they say, let's go back here. Because Moshe was distressed, the Holy Blessed One concealed the way to erect it from them. And that's why they were unable to do so. In other words, Moshe wanted a part in it, and so God didn't give them the secret message code that would help them stand up the temple, or the tabernacle, sorry. After they had tried in every way to do so and still were unable to set it up, the Israelites approached Moshe, saying, Moshe, our master, everything you have told us we've done, and everything you asked us to bring and to give, we have given. As it says, behold, all of the work of the tabernacle. V'yar Moshe et kol ha-malacha v'hine. Okay. Perhaps we overlooked something, or perhaps something else should be added to what you told us. See, everything is here. We followed your instructions. And they showed it to him, as it says, they brought the tabernacle unto Moshe, and Moshe saw all the work. They're like playing with all these verses to say, here, they're trying to finish it, but they're not able to finally get it to stand. And so Moshe has to come along. Now, what's the conclusion of that story? Surely Moshe's going to be able to do it, but not so fast. Did you not tell us to do such and such? And Moshe replied, yes. And so they pointed to everything that had been done, and they said, if that's so, why does it not stand? We've tried to have Bezalel, Ohaliav, and the wise-hearted erect it, but they were unable to do so. Moshe was troubled by all of this until the Holy Blessed One told him, Moshe, because you were unhappy over the fact that you did not share in the work of the tabernacle, these wise men were not able to erect it. Now Israel will know that if you do not erect it, it will never be set up. Okay. Have I not written previously that it would be done by you? Here, we're coming to the end. As it said, and Moshe raised up the tabernacle. And it also says, and the Lord spoke unto Moshe, saying, in the first day of the month shall you raise up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. Okay, but this is the ending of the story. Moshe replied, Master of the universe, I don't know how to erect it either. I don't know how to stand the tabernacle up. I want to help. I want to, but none of us know how to actually finally get this thing to stand. It keeps falling down. And God said to him, apply yourself to it, and it will stand up of itself. Here's it in Hebrew. Amar lo, asok biyadecha, do what you can, work with your hands. Ve'ata mar'eh lahamido, v'hu omed me'alav. You will kind of show it how to stand up, and then it will stand up on its own. Okay? Apply yourself to it, and it will stand up of itself, for I have written concerning that you will raise it as it said, and the same verses, it came to pass in the first month, in the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was raised up, and who finally set it up? Moshe, as it says, Moshe raised up the tabernacle. But that line now means something different, which is that Moshe couldn't raise the tabernacle, nobody could raise the tabernacle, but God said, you, Moshe, go out and try to raise the tabernacle, and then it will just spring up on its own. Okay. So let's consider this as a kind of a counter voice to everything, all the empowerment, the agency, and the human glory of building a house for God. It turns out they couldn't do it. They did everything they could, but they could not get it to stand. So finally they turned to Moshe, and yes, Moshe gets credit, but Moshe didn't really do it. He just did what he could, and then the tabernacle stood on its own. In other words, God is the one who in the end created a world for God's self, in a way, right? And that sort of flips the whole theology on its head. We can't create a world for God to dwell in. We can't. We try, but it doesn't quite work. In the end, it keeps falling over. There's a metaphor here that I want to process with you in this last time that we have. So I invite sort of last reflections on this after all of the work of the tabernacle. The Torah goes to so much work, giving us all that parallel language. The Midrash goes to so much work and making all the connections. Modern scholars go to all that, we've been doing all this work. And then this other Midrash comes along and says, yeah, but in the end, it kept falling over. It just kept falling. You just can't build a house for God. I mean, what does that mean? All right, so I'm going to turn to folks who have their hands up. And I welcome anyone else who hasn't had a chance to speak. Ariella.
Well, I think people have to have the faith. And without that kavanah, without that intention that they had faith, because without the faith, the building isn't going to stand. And they had to have that faith. That's their partnership with God.
Good. That's really good. Ariella, I think, is picking up on just a nuance here in this Midrash, which is that what we said was, you do what you can, you start it, and then it will stand up on its own. So it's not just that the tabernacle, you have to just sort of throw up your hands and say, well, I guess only God can make a Mishkan. No, we do the work. But God completes it, and we sort of believe if we you know, what's the famous Pirkei Avot? You know, it's not your work to finish. And that's the same language, lo alecha melacha ligmor, right? You also can't just say I. You have to do work, but then have faith that God will complete the work. And is there something kind of like
throw your hands up?
Yeah, you can't throw your hands up, right? You have to, and the opposite. You have to use your hands. This is a little bit like Nachshon, I think, what Ariel is describing. That sort of midrash about the first one who walks into the sea before it parts. And then the sea parts. But you have to show your investment in the project. And maybe that's what this is all about. You know, what does it mean for God to dwell in the world? Well, we can't really fathom that. But God wants to see that we tried to build a place for God. That we put effort into the desire of the project to have God on earth. And that's enough. And then God will finish. I don't know. How do you bring God on earth? God will have to deal with that issue. But Ariel is right that we have to lend a hand to show our commitment, our faith in the project. Okay, Kathy.
Okay, so first I wanted to go back to what Yonatan said, which I thought was really amazing. So this difference between the temple, this fixed place for God, and then the moving, the tabernacle, and the kind of fluidity of that. And I was thinking about going back to the parallel to creation. And so to me, the parallel there is the Garden of Eden is a fixed place. And we oftentimes, it's the ideal, it's the perfection, whatever. But in fact, maybe the, better maybe is not the right word, but the better kind of parallel is moving, the moving part, the dispersion from the garden, that's actually the more dynamic part of the whole thing. And in fact, would we really have wanted to just stay in the garden and had God there and very close and, it's everything. In fact, not be able to tell, not have the knowledge of the difference between good and evil, not go out and make all kinds of mistakes and mess up and, do everything. So I feel like it's almost like saying, that in some ways the Mishkan metaphor is in some ways the more powerful one, just in the sense that our going out into the world and screwing up is really the more powerful story than us just sitting in the Garden of Eden.
Okay. Kathy's doing two things that she often does. One is to make a like sort of devastatingly searing, staggeringly significant point that sort of like forces us to rethink all of Judaism. But the other one is brings us back to the Garden of Eden. Kathy's always heading back to the Garden of Eden. And that's right. The staggering nature of the point is really, impossible to deal with here with 3 minutes left. But yeah, building on Kathy's right, building on Yonatan's earlier point, maybe we're actually seeing something quite significant, or at least playing with the significance of the idea of place versus movement in this tradition. And is it important to have a place? Like the Garden of Eden was a place, like the temple is a place, like Israel is a place. We have a land, a holy land, the holy land, Israel. But on the other hand, the most of the Torah story takes place outside, like we're heading to the land, we're always heading to the place. And much of Jewish history has been defined in this way, right? Like we are wanderers, even as we hold the significance of a particular place. And that's, I think that, that there's a lot of thinking to be done. For today's purposes, I would just say that the question, we're asking the question in the specific context of how that connects us to God. Do we experience God in a particular place? Do you have a place in the world that you go to, a tree, a house, a temple that you go to and you feel the presence of God? Maybe you do, and there's something powerful about that. Or do you have a sense that God can travel with us everywhere? And that's like a huge question about Jewish history, the significance of Jewish history as a whole, and certainly a huge question about where and how we worship. Okay, one last comment from Diana.
Yeah, I was just, this is exactly the point where I was headed to as well. Sort of the contrast between the temple and the Mishkan and the carrying of God with us, only in the sense of Jews have often thought of themselves as people of exile, just because of the historical trauma of the loss of the temple. And I just wonder, playing with this idea of the Mishkan and the portability of it, if the concept and idea of exile away from the temple and of the holy places is not mitigated or could not have been mitigated by the idea or concept of a more of a portability of a God's home with us as we carried it with us down through the centuries. And maybe the term exile would have had a mitigated sting associated with it if that had been more of a glommed onto concept, because that has been so damaging and so traumatic for the Jewish people as a whole. Just a thought I was thinking about. In
good, this good, good. That's, again, we're out of time, so we won't have too much to space here to really tease that out. But I mean, Diana's reminding us of really the term, the Jewish lexicon offers us a massive term for this sort of thinking, galut. Galut is the term, right? And we have been in galut, in exile. And that's a big part. You know, when we pray for redemption, we're praying for the opposite of this. And yet, I'm a gullus dikayid, you know? Like, I was forged in the exile. And a lot of Judaism has been forged in the exile. And in fact, in a sense, the Torah itself is forged in the exile in the desert. So that is that's a real question. And did we... you know, one way of asking that question is, did the Torah, did Moshe, did the rabbis, did this whole tradition come up with a way of carrying God's presence with us wherever we are, so it no longer matters where we are? Is that the great revolution? Or do we still hold on to some idea that we got to get back to the place and build, you know, the structure that will finally and magnificently contain the glory of God on earth? This impossible thing to do. Can we do it? And what really would it take? So we'll leave with those questions, of course, still unanswered. May Mashiach come one day and provide all of the answers that we are seeking. All right. Wishing you all Shabbat Shalom. Thanks for the learning today.
Okay, that's it. A taste of our weekly Parsha class. I want to thank everyone who came to the class, some of whose voices you may have heard today, some you didn't because the podcast has been edited. So just want to thank everybody. And speaking of editing, I want to thank also our editor, Vera Blossom, for her great work. If you'd like to join our class sometime and come and join our circle of Torah geeks, you can find us again, Thursdays, 12 p.m. online at ikar.org. That's ikar.org. And if you go to the calendar, then you can find a Zoom link and just click in. And in the section on the website that we keep our classes, you can, if you click on Parsha Study, you'll find all of our archived classes and source sheets and everything we discuss there. So if you're looking for a regular Parsha class, I'd love to see you. And in the meantime, I will talk to you next week.